day war between Israel and Iran, when he sent American bombers to bomb the nuclear facilities in Iran. So that was, again, that's another tick for
that's
Trump.
Three, he's doing well.
Yeah, India and Pakistan. Well, there were skirmishes and, in fact, dogfights between India and Pakistan planes after some a border dispute erupted, re-erupted, of course, in the Kashmir area. There's an uneasy piece there. It did break out again, and Trump got on the phone again. I think this one is a watch and see, because India says that Trump had nothing to do with making peace, whilst Pakistan has nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize. So that one's a sort of a...
We're running out of time here. He's solved so many wars that it's quite incredible. Overall, do you think he deserves his the name President of Peace, just very briefly?
I would say that the man who also renamed the Department of Defense the Department of War, the jury is very much out. And there are those who say, if you give him the prize in 2026, will he take his foot off the gas and all this focus that he's put on trying to make peace, which he has done in several areas, will he simply forget about it? So I would say wait until 2028, Dom.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I wanted to talk about Zoran Mamdani's inauguration as the new mayor of New York tomorrow, but we can't. We've run out of time. David Charter, The Times US assistant editor there, thank you very much.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, it's 2 o'clock. I'm Dom Jolly and you're listening to Times Radio. Coming up in the next hour, I'll be joined by a former diplomat to discuss the ongoing protests in Iran, sparked by a cost of living crisis and the government's response. And Helen Brown will be here to review some of the biggest songs of 2025, including Lily Allen's Major Combat, but I promise, no goth music. First, the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. New figures show UK spending on investment is the lowest in the G7 at about 18.6% of GDP. While public spending is to rise by billions next year, the data for the 3 months to September shows private investment hasn't been boosted. Professor Sir Anton Muscatelli is an economist and president of the Royal Society of Edinburgh.
Business investment levels are important because they're one of the key drivers of growth in the economy. The way the economy grows is by growing human capital, but it's also by growing fixed capital and investment in machinery and in equipment and technology. And it's that last bit that business investment represents. And, you know, having a higher rate of business investment means higher rates of growth.
On one of the busiest days for travel, passengers at the Eurotunnel in Calais are being warned of delays of up to 6 hours. Eurostar was forced to cancel most London to Europe services yesterday following a power failure in the Channel Tunnel. The train network's now resuming a full schedule, but the disruption's been costly. Travel expert Simon Calder says many will be protected by insurance.
Otherwise, well, you can try and contact Eurostar and say, look, you let me down. But that's going to be quite a tough legal fight. And the overall passenger rights rules for people on international trains are very different from those on flights.
Thieves have also caused disruption to train services in South Yorkshire after they stole signalling cables. National Rail has said it happened at Conisbrough between Doncaster and Sheffield and will affect cross-country Northern and Transpennine Express services between the two stations. Cathy Adams from the Times Travel Desk says the impact covers a wider area too.
That is happening between Doncaster and Sheffield in South Yorkshire, and trains are delayed and cancelled. Not only, you know, in that portion of the world, but also the line, you know, trains that use that particular line to run from, say, Edinburgh to Birmingham, they are also being affected.
Newly built council houses could become the answer to end the use of asylum hotels. Around 200 local authorities have indicated interest in a government pilot scheme that would fund new properties or refurbish derelict buildings. George Pascoe Watson is a former political editor of The Sun and says long-term politics often focus on immediate issues.
You can make an argument that over the longer period, Britain's housing stock will grow if we use taxpayers' money to do this. Politics is about the here and now, and for a politician now to make a decision which will perhaps improve the nation's council housing stock in 10 years' time, then, of course, it's not going to do you any favours.
One pub a day shut permanently last year as rising costs continue to hit the industry. New figures show 366 pubs across England and Wales were demolished or converted in 2025, taking the total number down to just over 38,600. Industry leaders call it a drastic situation ahead of higher property tax payments for many from April. And Joe Root insists England's cricketers are desperate to finish the Ashes on a high. They ended an 18-match winless streak in Australia with a victory in the Boxing Day test in Melbourne. The final match of the series begins on Saturday in Sydney. Despite the urn staying in Australia, Root says they can leave the country with respect if they can get a second win.
Every test match matters and it's a huge opportunity for the group, so hopefully we can do as we did last week, play some good stuff, and you've got to keep looking at what the next opportunity is and what the next challenge is, and you know, we've just got to put a good foot forward next week.
And for News Bulletin when you want it, search the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to me, Dom Jolly. I am filling in for Jane and Fee until 4 o'clock this afternoon, here all week. Coming up this hour, we will chat about the biggest songs of 2025, but I promise you I'll keep it goth-free, and whether the January sales are actually worth spending your money on. Now, I was asking you at the top of the last hour what your great New Year's Eve stories are, what are you planning to do, what was the weirdest ones. We've already been told absolutely under no circumstances go to a Japanese monastery. That's a no-no. You're quite an international lot. We got Chris here. Last year celebrated my newfound unemployment by heading to, I think it's Wroclaw. Anyway, somewhere in Poland with my family for New Year. Turns out the Polish attitude to firework health and safety is somewhat different to the UK. It certainly is. And I spent a terrifying 15 minutes trying to get my children back to our Airbnb from the main square, dodging fireworks being let off in all directions everywhere. But I bet you they enjoyed it. I'm sure they absolutely loved that. We've got Lynn here. Hi, Dom. The past couple of New Year's Eves we spent in Clay next the sea in a wonderful rented coaching inn. I have spent a New Year's Eve in Clay next the sea, I think in about 2000, Lynn, so we probably didn't cross over. This year, however, husband Gav could not get time off. He was excluded from the work's time off lottery due to previously winning 2 years on the bounce. I didn't know there were lotteries for that, but this year we'll be staying in, no doubt dozing off before midnight, but we will be drinking a very nice vintage champagne. LB from Bannock, please disable your Ring doorbell footage until tomorrow, as you won't enjoy your dinner at the Connaught later. You know way too much about what I'm up to, but that's all very, very good. If you want to tell me more about your plans, tell me how to pronounce places in Poland, tell me other places that are no-go zones, then absolutely contact me on 0333 003 2353. You can text us on 87222, start your message with the word Times, or you can email us studio@times.radio. You're probably wondering what the most read stories on the Times website are this afternoon. Luckily, I can tell you. Number three is millions swamp A&E in England for coughs and headaches. Numbers of people seeking emergency treatment for minor conditions has risen sharply since 2020, suggesting that other NHS services are not working properly. The second most read story is Tatiana Schlossberg obituary, journalist and JFK's granddaughter, the science and climate writer who spoke out against her cousin Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s appointment as health secretary, sadly died aged 35, it says here. And the most 35, that's terrible. And the most read piece on the Times website is GP faked appointments to avoid being late to pick up children. Dr. Helen Eisenhower, who's probably not having a great New Year's Eve, has been suspended for 5 months after admitting to fabricating appointments to help manage childcare. And you can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You'll obviously need your digital subscription. And if you don't have one, well, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. Over to Iran. Iran's government is calling for dialogue with protest leaders after the largest demonstrations in the country in recent years. They've been triggered by anger over the soaring cost of living after a plunge in value of the country's currency. Protesters have been chanting anti-government slogans and calling the names of leaders ousted in the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Sir Peter Westmacott, former British ambassador to Turkey and the United States, joins me now. Sir Peter, thanks for joining me. Are these protests mostly about the cost of living, or are there ever other grievances behind them?
Hello, Dom. Can I just pick up on your last point and say that I do think Tatiana Schlossberg's piece that she wrote just a month before she died is well worth reading by anybody who's either in the healthcare business or has sadly had to deal with cancer. It's a very moving article, so thank you for mentioning that.
No, it's very sad news, yeah.
Very sad news, but what a beautifully written piece that she did last month. I started my career in Iran, Dom, so I think that's probably why you're asking me to come and talk about it, although I've also dealt with Iran and foreign policy in Washington and elsewhere over my career. Yes, there's a lot going on in Iran. They are, at the moment, very fed up with the economy. They've sacked the central bank governor. The currency has collapsed by 40% in the last 6 months. It's now, you know, millions of lira to the dollar, and people are feeling very hard up. They're also pretty fed up with the incompetence and, I would say, corruption of the government. This has been going on for a while. And you remember a couple of years back, there were widespread protests by women in particular about the death of Mahsa Amini, the girl who was probably beaten to death by the morality police for wearing her headscarf in the wrong way. So there's been a lot of unhappiness in Iran for quite a while. And at the moment, it does seem to be, you know, a bit more significant. You've seen the president of Iran saying, we've got to talk to the protesters, the president. You've seen foreign agents, actors, if you like, in Israel and America and elsewhere, calling on the Iranian people to rise up and overthrow the regime. Well, that's not going to happen. But there is a great deal of unhappiness. And it looks as though, if you look at the numbers of people in the streets and the way in which some of the police are on the run, this has got real momentum behind it. It's a long way from saying there's going to be political regime change, but it is significant.
Yeah, we've seen these sort of protests. They sort of happen every 5-6 years. There were ones about 10 years ago, I think, which were sort of launched on Twitter and looked hopeful for a bit, but kind of fell away. What impact did the US strikes on Iran have on popular support for the government?
I think at the time, there was an understandable reaction from a lot of Iranians saying, you know, we may not like the guys who are running our country into the ground, but we're damned if we'll have large bombs dropped on us illegally, they would say, by America or Israel or both. So there was a sense of, if you like, national coming together, but it wasn't as strong as you might normally expect. And I think what's gone on since then, apart from the resistance to the old-fashioned and rather theocratic approach to women and women's rights and women's behavior, is that public opinion in Iran is beginning to ask itself some big questions. You know, Iran is no longer the significant player in the region with powerful proxies in Hamas and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and in Yemen and so on, and they've lost their regime friend in Syria. They're looking pretty weak. And Iran is paying a big price in terms of sanctions. Maximum pressure, as Donald Trump calls it. And people are beginning to say, you know what? What's the point of all this? Why do we have a nuclear program which we are told is not for nuclear weapons and we just get smacked every time we do something about enrichment? What's the point in saying death to Israel? We don't care about Israel. We used to have a very vibrant and happy Jewish community in Iran. You know, why are we setting ourselves up for trouble with other countries unnecessarily at a time when the country is largely bankrupt and extremely badly run? These debates, I think, are quite new. It's hard to judge how widespread they are, but I think there's some questioning going on from people who've, many of them, of course, never been that enthusiastic about the theocratic Ayatollah regime. Many of them wanted a revolution for other reasons back in the 40 years ago. But, you know, we are where we are, but there's unhappiness about a lot of different issues. And if America and Israel started dropping bombs again, which is what Trump and Netanyahu were talking about in Mar-a-Lago a couple of days ago, you know, that we'd have to see what would be the reaction. My guess is that Iranian people would feel this was not reasonable and that it would not weaken the regime. But you never know. The government is weak at the moment, and it is under attack from a lot of its own people for its own inadequacies. So I think, you know, at the moment, all bets are off.
Is there any form of official or semi-official opposition that people could rally around?
There is talk, as there has been for quite a while, of the son of the late Shah coming back from Washington in the United States where he lives. He's 65 years old, Reza Pahlavi, who would love to come back. I think it's a very long shot. For a long time, even those people who are very critical of the regime do not really think that going back to the Pahlavi monarchy is the answer. But there's more talk of it this time than there was before. Apart from that, not really. There isn't the sort of focal point that you would normally need if you're expecting a revolution to overturn a regime, the sort of thing that you saw in Iran in 1979, or you've just seen in Syria recently, or which you've seen in other countries where revolutions have been successful. I suspect that the best chance for improvement in the life of the poor, long-suffering Iranian people is in domestic pressure on the regime to let up and behave better, which is what the president, I think, Pezeshkian, would like. I suspect that's more likely than some sort of external military action leading to suddenly a magnificent change of regime and democracy arriving overnight. That doesn't seem to me to be extremely likely.
And even though the 1979 revolution was a theocratic one, it was kind of led by students, wasn't it? And what are the chances that the kind of the students of today's Iran will lead another one?
Well, I wouldn't say it was led by students. They were definitely in the vanguard, you're right. And there were the bazaar merchants and there were the liberal lawyers. There were a lot of people who were fed up with the way in which the secret police were operating, although I don't think they're nearly as bad as some of those who came after them. But in the end, the reason why it succeeded was because, I think mistakenly, the Shah's regime decided to blame Ayatollah Khomeini, who was living in exile in Saddam Hussein's Iraq at the time. And that created a great kind of religious turmoil, fervor, if you like, of millions of people in the streets calling for change, which might not have happened if they hadn't taken on the Shia theocracy. So there was a series of different circumstances which led to that revolution. The students on their own would not have delivered change, and I don't think students on their own will now. But, you know, you've got the bazaar, you've got the middle classes, you've got the business community, you've got a lot of liberal professionals who've until now not been out in the streets with the students, who are all saying, you know, we can't go on like this. And a president, you know, the president of the Islamic Republic saying pretty much the same thing. So I think something's going to have to change, but I don't see the regime being overthrown by demonstrating students.
Fascinating stuff, and something definitely keep our eye on in the next year. But thank you very much for joining me. That was Sir Peter Westmacott, senior British diplomat, former British ambassador to Turkey and the United States. Now, coming up, Helen Brown is here to reflect on the past year in music. It's 2:15. This is Dom Jolly on Times Radio.
New Year's Day breakfast with Jane Mulkerins on Times Radio. Join Jane Mulkerins for a brighter breakfast as she looks forward to whatever 2026 may bring. New Year's Day breakfast with Jane Mulkerins. Tomorrow morning from 7 on Times Radio.
Incredible snorkeling.
Carnival!
Sunrises and sunsets.
Grilled lobster.
Poppycats and kayaking.
Morning swim.
Pina coladas.
Serene spas.
If you love the sound of a Caribbean holiday, then Sandals have every little thing covered. Do it all or do nothing at all. Your perfect holiday is waiting at sandals.co.uk. Sale now on. Atoll protected.
As you can hear from my voice, I'm in a state of high exhilaration. Yes, I am positively beside myself. The reason that I can barely contain my enthusiasm is the IKEA Winter Sale. 4 weeks of incredible bargains. The inexpressible thrill of finding precisely the right thing at the right price. Sale now on IKEA. The wonderful everyday.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to me, Dom Jolly. I am here until 4 p.m. Now, we're going to do a little bit more music. I know we did a lot of music yesterday and I kind of indulged my goth fetish, but I promise you, I think we're going to be fairly goth-free. And this is going to be a look at more general music of the year. 2025 has been one of those years in music where it feels like something's been happening all the time. From Lily Allen's very public, very personal, and rather brilliant comeback to breakout artists like Lola Young making headlines and indie bands like Geese suddenly finding a much bigger audience. Here to help digest all that is Helen Brown, music journalist, who joins me now. Hello, Helen.
Good afternoon, Dom. How are you?
I'm very excited we're going to talk about geese, because actually when my production team asked me what things I was interested in, one of the things I wrote was the rise of geese, and they're not quite up with indie music, and so I think they thought I was really into the feathered type of geese. But
especially when you said the rise of geese, right? Yeah. There's a little takeoff. They have finally taken flight this year.
But look, we'll talk about geese in a minute. How would you firstly sum up this year in music?
What I was going to say, and I didn't notice this, and I was looking at my favourite songs of the year and my favourite albums of the year for you, is it feels like 2025 was the year that artists and bands across all genres kind of lent into a certain reckless chaos. So, you know, you mentioned Lola Young there, but also Geese, people like Lily Allen. They're all leaning into a certain kind of mess. We've got a big mashup of genres. We've got people throwing every emotion in the one song. Perhaps the biggest exemplar of this would be the Spanish artist Rosalía, whose album Lux saw her smashing together every genre. You know, she's putting reggaeton, pop, techno and classical with the LSO in there. She's singing in 13 different languages, you know, from German through Arabic, Mandarin, Ukrainian. She's got rap, she's got opera. And people have actually enjoyed this. I think the world feels a bit like too much information.
I agree.
And music has reflected that back at us this year.
We're talking about too much information. Why don't we start by taking a listen to one of the most talked about releases of the year?
Madeline.
Who is Madeline indeed? There we had the gloriously named non-monogamy, sleepwalking, yes, and tennis from Lily Allen's latest album, Western Girl. I love this album. How about you?
Absolutely adored it. And I think as a pop critic, I have spent the last decade unpicking the cryptic clues of pop artists like Taylor Swift, who, you know, her fans spend forever online trying to work out which lyric is about which relationship, you know, which famous guy where. And there was something spectacularly British about literally pegging out every detail of your personal dirty laundry. No mystery, here it all is, and set to these really acidic tunes. You know, there's a prettiness with the acid, like she's absolutely not pretending to be any kind of heroine. And again, it's a mess, right? It's a messy relationship that she's singing about. It's an open relationship where the rules seem unclear, and you've got this intrusive thought breaking in, you know, who's Madeline? I think it's really hard not to hear that record and just find yourself, you know, making a cup of tea and going, who is Madeline?
That would have been a great name for the album, actually, Intrusive Thoughts. For people who haven't listened to it, it's incredibly personal album, and essentially, you know, just lays it all out there with TMI about her ex-husband, David Harbour. Do you think it crosses a line?
There is a danger of that. You know, even my kids are huge Stranger Things fans. They're very excited
about it.
Massive. Yeah. Still there. I can't even. My household is literally, they've decorated the entire other side of my land like the upside down. So yeah, big excitement for tonight. But yeah, so they're big Stranger Things fans. They you know, we haven't heard David Harbour's side. And this is really true, you know, and Lily Allen has said it's a fictionalized version of her relationship. But you know what? Sometimes it's a massive relief when someone just says what's going on, as opposed to hinting at it. As a journalist, I'm constantly interviewing pop stars who are dancing around the realities. And there is just some love, especially in the sort of post-truth society, there is a kind of glory to just literally dropping it and saying everything you feel.
It is funny.
David Harbour will, you know, he's not a voiceless man. man, right? He has a right to reply.
Yeah, I mean, I presume we're not expecting a return album from him, but it is interesting that in this time of, you know, celebs being surrounded by PRs and not being allowed to answer any questions, and then suddenly she just answers everything in an album. And you can imagine PRs just going, what on earth are you doing? But actually, once it's out there, it's absolutely brilliant. How does it differ from her previous albums? I mean, because I've always loved Lily Allen, I have to say. I think she's an incredible character and an incredible talent.
Yeah, I think it's the speed of it, it's the directness of it, and maybe it's, I think, the wisdom that she's accrued, you know, when she's sort of, I mean, it's 20 years since that debut Smile came out, and we saw her kind of jauntily zipping around London, and she's owning her own part in this messy marriage on this album. You know, she's not just blaming the ex, she's singing about what she signed up for. In interviews she's spoken about, she now realises how bad her first husband felt when he cheated on her. She's, you know, I kind of like the just the disgorging of it all.
I think she's
very British. I'm quite proud.
She's the dark Taylor Swift. You know, Swifties like the idea that they've kind of grown up listening to her life, and actually we've done the same thing with Lily Allen with quite a big break.
Taylor Swift is making friendship bracelets and Lily Allen's kind of sort of puncturing her own ship, like merrily, you know.
It's been a big year for female artists, hasn't it? Alongside Lily, we've had, I loved Olivia Dean, you said Rosalia, Lola Young I was obsessed with, and also I would do a big shout out to Joy Crooks. I love Joy Crooks. Let's talk about Olivia Dean for a moment. Her latest album's called The Art of Loving, an absolute must listen.
I absolutely think so. It's funny that I was talking about sort of the mess and the chaos, and Olivia Dean's first album was called Messy. But what I actually loved about this year and this album is the composure. This woman is, so she's in contrast. This is a woman who's only 26, and somehow into the discord and chaos, she drops this kind of warm bath of love and acceptance. You know, at these time of the gender wars that Lily Allen is singing about, we've actually got Olivia Dean opening up and telling men, this is a way for you to be great in 2026. You know, I have a 16-year-old boy. He is absorbing all this sort of fear and shame around the patriarchy. And suddenly there's this lovely woman whose mother is, I think, one of the founders of the Women's Equality Party, telling men, you know, just talk to me. Literally, tell me how it is. I'm going to fit in with your mates. We're going to make this work. And all it takes is a bit of communication. So it's this lovely synth bath of genuine, soothing kind of R&B soul with this gentle olive branch held out.
I was obsessed this year with Lola Young. When I heard Messy, I honestly, I could not stop playing that song. I was an early adopter of it. I just would like to point that out. I was right there at the beginning. I absolutely loved that song. And I was obsessed with Lola Young. She's so interesting as an artist. Why do you think she connected so strongly with audiences?
I think, again, it's that slight blurtiness, the confessional, isn't it? And it's the impossibility of getting it right. I mean, we're all on the receiving end of social media that's one minute telling us to meditate and calm down and the next minute telling us to express our anger and our authenticity. You know, we are all too, you know, blanking messy and then too clean. We're all ping-ponging between extremes trying to find that sort of ADHD-esque reality. And there was Lola Young kind of just bluntly singing it.
Well, singing it, but singing it for real, because her next song was called Dealer, wasn't it? And then she made headlines after fainting on stage at the All Things Go Festival. What happened there?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure exactly what happened.
I think I'm sure.
But I think what I do think, again, is interesting is that given, you know, the long history of pop and rock artists and drug addiction, she's the first artist I can think of who's written a sort of a breakup song with her dealer.
Yeah. Elton John loved it. Elton John was a big fan of hers, but I unfortunately she went into rehab straight after that, and she was recovering, and then she chose to make her first public appearance at Lily Allen's album launch party or birthday party, which is probably not the place that I would come out of rehab to. But let's move on from that. Heading across the Atlantic, Geese, that we were talking about earlier, that confused my young production team and made me feel incredibly hip. They're a Brooklyn-based rock band, formed actually ages ago in 2016, but this year they've really broken through. Let's have a listen.
Nail me down. stay with me. You can stay with me and just pretend I'm not there. Like a sailor in a big green boat. Like a sailor in a big green coat. Baby, let me dance away.
So there we heard Taxes, Orpide, Cocaine and Cobra from their latest album, Getting Killed. I was slightly in two minds. They were so being hyped that I'm a bit of a contrarian. I thought, I don't want to like it, but I do really, really like Geese. But do you think they live up to the hype?
I absolutely do. I think a lot of the charm lies in Cameron Winter's amazing vocals that we just heard there. My friend, the critic Roisin O'Connor, said that he sways between sort of the Tom York angst and the Mick Jagger swagger in his vocals. And you really feel that. Again, that's sort of part of this vibe of, you know, sort of embracing it all. And I think what also I love about them is the sense of humour. You know, this is a band that, you know, they do look at the seriousness of the world. You know, this is an album called Getting Killed. But it's also looking at sort of a mental health crisis in the context of what is, you know, a sort of historically great, you know, period of living standards. So, you know, he sings, I'm getting killed by a pretty good life.
Yeah, you know, tough work that. They remind me in a way of a slower, sadder version of the Strokes. There's definitely that kind of thing. But if you describe their sound, what sets them apart from other indie bands right now?
I think it is that sort of slightly raw racketiness. I mean, it is that grimy basement, but there's, again, with the Isle of Wight British band, where, like, there's a kind of lovely punky edge, a kind of raw rubberiness that you can actually get some kind of purchase on. I think a lot of music feels like it's sliding off us right now.
Yeah.
And there is a friction, isn't it? It's like a rubber on tarmac kind of contact with that sound.
As usual, though, I'm not bringing a lot of my listeners with me. Phil says, sounds like dragging a cat through a mangle backwards. That's just the sort of music I like, personally.
I mean, that does sound like one of their lyrics.
It does. Someone called the Caner Man says, Geese sound like substandard Pete Perrett and the only ones. Well, there you go. Listen, we've run out of time, Helen, but thank you so much. I really enjoyed that. That was Helen Brown, music journalist, taking me through some of her favourite stuff from the last year. It is 2:30. Coming up, are the January sales worth it or just a rip-off? We'll speak to consumer journalist Harry Wallop. But first, the headlines with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Emergency services have confirmed a death in a house fire in southeast Wales. They were called to reports of flames at a home in Glenboy in Mountain Ash in the early hours. The number of patients in hospital in England with flu is levelling off, but officials say pressure on units remain high and they warn things could get worse again with temperatures expected to fall. Meanwhile, millions of people are going to A&E for minor problems like earache, coughs and hiccups. Nearly 2 million patients sought emergency care for headaches in the past 5 years. GP Dr. Bashka Mukherjee says primary care needs a stronger and more reliable system.
Majority of inefficiencies are actually happening in hospitals. That's part of the reason why we're seeing so much of a drain in the NHS altogether. And yet this is the problem, that they won't redirect the funds towards empowering GPs and keeping people well in the community.
On the back of these forecasts, the UK Health Security Agency has decided to increase amber cold alerts. Two were initially identified. They've now been expanded to cover the whole of England. And as preparations continue across the UK to welcome 2026, Australians are already celebrating. But there was a minute's silence before the big firework display to remember the 15 people killed by two gunmen at a Jewish event in the city earlier this month. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
At Morrisons, mix and match on three packs of the best party food and get one free. Serve up fancy New Year's Eve nibbles like lobster and prawn mac and cheese bites, prawn coconut curry donuts, and then do your croquettes with tomato chilli jam.
Morrisons, to shop at Morrisons.
Majority of stores and online. Prices may vary at Morrisons daily. 176 to 304 grams, £6 each. Offer ends 31st of December.
We travel to explore, to learn, to connect.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Our itineraries are designed to help you explore and engage with your destination through its food, culture, and customs. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Right, brace yourself. At Co-op, you can get two pizzas and a tub of Ben & Jerry's for a fiver. Yep, a fiver. It's kind of a big deal, eh?
You're unbelievable.
Co-op, owned by you, right by you.
Ends 2nd of January. Selected products subject to availability. Co-op Group food stores only. See co-op.co.uk for details.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast. 7 days a week from 6 a.m. This is Times Radio.
Right, we are back, and we are back with Ollie Mann. What's
Hello,
happening? Your drive. We've not managed this week yet to
straightforwardly promote the show.
But then I'm only getting revenge, because when I come in talking to Lord Vasey, gosh, we're off to
Harbour. He goes off on one, doesn't he?
We're off to Harbour Island. We're doing all sorts of stuff. So, yeah.
I like it. I like a loose promo.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, I'll stimulate you thusly, Dom.
Okay.
Yeah. Despite the fact it's the last day of the year, I'm going to give you two words that I've learned today. Well, I didn't learn the words, but I learned them in this context.
Yeah.
Right? The first, short ticketing. Do you know what that is?
Short ticketing. Sounds like criminal behaviour.
It is.
Okay.
I didn't know this until this morning.
Is this like, is this dynamic pricing type stuff?
No, this is all about consumer power, but done illegally.
Ooh.
So from Ben Ellery's piece on the Times website today, he's been spending some time with the fare dodging chaps at Waterloo Station.
All right.
What it is buying a ticket for the train you're on when you're on the train.
Ah, yeah, and then you claim you got on at Didcot Parkway.
That's what
someone coming from Cheltenham would do if they were really, really bad.
Yeah, well, except Cheltenham, I believe there are gates, right? There are stations without gates.
Yes, that's true.
So you get on, and this is not advice,
illegal. Kingham, for instance, is one of them.
There you go. Yeah. So you get on where there's no gates, and then you pay for one stop of the train, and then you get off with a valid ticket, supposedly.
That They're really clamping down on it. Terrible behaviour, it really is.
Well, we're going to be talking about that, fare dodging.
Yeah.
And it's a plague, it's an epidemic, says Ben. He's going to tell me. There was one woman, apparently, who dodged £400 worth in fares.
How do they backtrack? Do they trace you on your phone?
Yeah. Yes. So they're consolidating information, all of the ticketing apps.
You know what? I think we are so ripped off by the train companies in this and the prices. I mean, where I live, it's almost mile per mile, the most expensive railway journey in the world. And I think anything you can get back is fine. I'm not saying commit crime.
No, it's the justification people use for the shoddy service, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then the cost, I mean, I came from Stevenage today. It's £22 return to London Bridge. I mean, if you're on minimum wage, that's 2 hours work, isn't it? And if the train doesn't turn up, you're going to feel angry about that.
Yeah, I mean, I make most of mine up from getting the money back from GWR because they're always late. But anyway,
The other word that I've learned is coasting. What is coasting?
What's what?
Coasting.
Coasting?
Coasting.
Well, I've been coasting all my life, but what does that mean?
I know. You get to middle age and that's exactly what you want in your career,
right? Is that what it is?
It isn't.
Oh.
What coasting is, is drinking drinks that are not... New Year's Eve story.
Is it swingers?
Not as exciting as that. It is neither no or low alcohol nor full-bodied spirits. It's the in-between lane.
So what? That's just beer and... Beer and wine below 12%?
Yeah.
Is that what we're talking about? What do we mean?
I think sort of 4% kind of thing.
4% wine?
I need to look into it.
I'm going dry Jan tomorrow, so this is you coming in.
Are you actually doing that?
You coming in and just... You're putting it in front of me like this.
What I do, actually, you know how, like, Jack Black in Tenacious D does the thing where he has, like, one Coke and one Diet Coke and mixes them together?
Oh, no, you're not one of those.
I'm that person.
You are. So you work out how much you drink over the year and then reduce it by a month load over 12. I mean,
oh, no, I don't do that. No, I don't do that. That's insane.
You're one in, one out.
No. No, I was going to say
that sounds wrong.
When I'm out drinking,
yeah,
I mix the full-bodied alcohol with the no alcohol. So I can have two drinks.
They're called cocktails.
Sure.
I learned a thing. I was in Russia, and I'm going to name drop here, because in Russia, where you go and they just give you just shot after shot,
you have to
do a shot to your mother, your father, whatever.
Get one at
you
the
can't
airport.
Deal with it. Yeah. And so Michael Palin told me that you always have to sit next to a pot plant in Russia, and then in sort of every third drink, you point at something and pour your drink into that. And that saved me on many an occasion.
What's it done to the pot plants?
I don't know. Russian pot plants are the happiest in the world.
Anyway, I can't drop a name like Michael Palin, but I will be speaking to, Neil Ridley, the drinks writer, about all of that. What should be drinking this New Year's Eve and the trends for 2026.
Nice.
Ready-to-drink cocktails, apparently.
Oh, they're big.
Flavoured vodka.
Yeah.
And mini cocktails, which sounds like mini cocktail. It sounds like cocktails with no fun, doesn't it, as far as I'm concerned?
Mini cocktail?
Yeah.
I guess. Just sounds like...
It's like a shot. I mean, like a little Benicol shot of cocktail.
I don't know. Utterly pointless. But yeah. I'm really looking forward to your show.
Thank you. The show's not pointless. The show's going to be great. Lots of breaking news, lots of politics chat as well.
You know what's great for me is I've never had any idea what's on your show so far. Today I know.
You're going to learn two words.
I'm going to learn.
Yeah, you don't know them.
I'm going to teach Vasey this tomorrow. Yeah. Except he's not even turning up tomorrow because he's... I don't know where he is. He's probably in Bermuda or something for New Year's Day. But you know he is, his butler and stuff. Anyway, thank you very much. That is Ollie Mann coming up at 4 o'clock for Drive. Now, the January sales will soon be upon us. But can we expect real bargains or cleverly disguised rip-offs? What's actually worth your hard-earned cash? And how can we stay savvy? Harry Wallop is a consumer expert, and he joins us now. Harry, thanks for joining me. There were reports of thousands queuing for Boxing Day sales. Are we set for similar in January? I mean, are January sales really still a thing? I did see the insane queues for Bicester Village. I mean, it was utterly off the chart.
Yeah, Bicester Village is its own weird universe, designed purely for Chinese tourists and people who think that this is somehow England. Where it's not, it's kind of a Hollywood version of England.
It's a very weird place.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't distinguish between Boxing Day sales and January sales.
Oh, okay.
I know that they are genuine sales on the part of retailers trying to shift things they have failed to sell. Well, most notably, things like Christmas decorations and, you know,
really?
IKEA.
People are buying Christmas decorations on Boxing Day.
Yeah, I've done that.
Have you?
Yeah.
You are so organised.
Well, no, I was in Fortnum & Mason's, which is a beautiful shop, but it's about 200% too expensive.
Yeah.
And therefore, you see their stunning decorations. You think, well, once they finally knocked 50% off, yeah, that's okay. I'll buy it. And then you feel so smug. There's nothing. IKEA have a 50% sale on. And in fact, our friend Martin Lewis, money-saving expert, his team have done quite a good sort of an analysis. So if you look at IKEA, it's an up to a 60% off. Up to often does a lot of heavy lifting.
Up to doing a lot of lifting, yeah.
Yeah, you only have to have one or two things with the 60% off, and then you can say everything's up to 60% off because, you know,
right.
I could be up to 8 foot tall, but I'm not.
Yes. I could be a good radio presenter, but that's not happening.
Gift bags. I mean, this is, if you're really, really, you know, scrimping and saving, you can go in and buy those quite good. If you're too lazy or not skillful enough to do your own Christmas wrapping, so you just put it in a nice paper bag, stripey or Christmassy. Christmas gift bags.
I do that, I have to say, because I'm a terrible wrapper.
Well, you need to go to IKEA because shifting tons of those. They were £2, they're now 50 pence. You get two. So it's 25 pence per bag. That, for instance, that is definitely, I mean, that is as a percentage. So, sorry, it's up to 60% off. The average discount in IKEA on 10 random items is 31% off.
So that's not bad.
It's not bad. And actually, some of the best at M&S. So M&S is an up to 50% off, and actually the average discount on is 44% off. So again,
well,
pretty good.
We're off there.
So they're decent sales.
Tell me, what's the difference between the sort of January sales and Black Friday?
Well, Black Friday is planned very much in advance. So all the suppliers, be it, you know, Mitsubishi or Samsung TVs, that's all negotiated with the suppliers. We want to put you in our Black Friday sale. We'll give you lots of free marketing. What discount are you going to give us, the retailer, that we will then pocket ourselves before passing it on to the consumer? So I think Black Friday, I'm very cynical about. The discounts are not that amazing. They're now spread out over a whole month. They're just designed to essentially get you Christmas shopping nice and early so they can get some cash in the tills in November rather than December. The January sales are more authentic in terms of them shifting stuff they haven't sold. And actually, this So we've had a very mild, I know it's quite chilly this week across the UK, but we've had a very mild autumn. So there's a lot of fashion. There's quite good bargains on fashion because people haven't gone out. We are psychological beasts and we buy winter overcoats when it's cold. So a lot of those fashion stores got a lot of coats and scarves and hats that they haven't sold and they need to get rid of them before, you know, they're already planning their spring stuff. So there is good bargains in fashion.
So they're sort of better and bad, you know, better and worse things to buy, like electronics, travel.
Well, yeah, toys, obviously, toys, Christmassy stuff, fashion. There's some electronics. I mean, Black Friday has kind of cornered the market on, you know, air fryers.
Black Friday to me is when you fight 10 people at a entrance to a place to take an enormous television out. I've seen online.
Yeah, those days are gone. Yeah. Those days are gone. And Black Friday is now essentially an online-only event, more or less.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, well, the best discounts are online.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask, actually. I mean, is it better to go, you know, to these sales on the high street or online?
I personally think on the high street because, you know, a lot of the discounts... I mean, the trick is... the online is obviously your friend and there are some amazing tools, amazing websites. Like, there's two I always recommend, a Price Runner and Price Spy. So if you find something you really like and it claims it's 50% off and you're just a bit cynical, is it really 50% off?
Yeah.
You cut and paste... Ooh. The item.
Yeah.
And so, for instance, Argos. Oh, no, Decathlon. Big fan of Decathlon.
I like Decathlon.
Swear. Yeah, yeah, love it. So there's some Adidas sliders. Not my style, it has to be said. I'm not a slider fan, but if you fancy them, it says 50% off.
Yeah.
Usually 30 quid, now 15 quid. You cut and paste the whole thing. It's an Adilette slider. And you put it into Price Runner or mm-hmm. Deep Price Spy. And you can see where, you know, A, it just compares it with all the other shops. Yes, indeed, it is cheap. It's cheaper than JD Sport. And it's cheaper than someone selling it for 19 quid and 20 quid. But it also has a price history.
Ooh.
It has a graph. You can go back in time. So you can see, is it really genuinely never been as cheap as this before? Or is it frequently? You know, every other month it goes down. And so you get to see how genuine the discounts are. And in this particular case, to give credit to Decathlon, it is actually a very good bargain.
So that's Price Runner. I'm going to be all over that.
Yeah, pricerunner.com. And there's also Price Spy. Okay. .co.uk or .com. I'm not sure. It's the same idea. They both do that whole thing. So it's not just comparing with other shops. It's comparing with history.
And finally, Harry, just briefly, a quick word on what to do with those annoying unwanted Christmas presents that come with no receipt.
Well, with notice, if it's from a good retailer, the likes of John Lewis or M&S, it's still got its tags on. Okay. If your relatives loved you, they kept the tags on.
Yeah, but my relatives buy from just rubbish places. They really do.
You
know, so.
Well, then, frankly, you've got your two options. You either just take it to the charity shop and have a warm glow about you, or you try and sell it on something like Vinted and get a bit of money back. But this is the charity shops, I think, this is what they love. They love things still in their packaging because then they can sell it for a decent amount of money and you can feel good about yourself.
I will try and feel good about myself. But thank you so much, Harry Wallop, there for taking us through the world of January sales, which just frightens me, I have to be honest with you. Coming up, Scott Bryan will give us his picks for the best TV shows of 2025. It's 2:45. This is Dom Jolly on Times Radio.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. A well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
If you're a sole trader or landlord, you've probably heard of Making Tax Digital for Income Tax. It means you'll need to use HMRC-recognized software like Xero to keep digital records, share quarterly updates, and submit your final tax return. But don't worry. New tax rules don't have to be a cause for stress. Xero accounting software can help you get MTD compliant and give you better control of your business finances. With Xero software, you can simply upload pictures of receipts on the go and send invoices with built-in payment options to help you get paid faster. With one subscription, you can manage multiple income streams, so everything you need is in one place, for one price. See how Xero can help you save time and stay on top of your finances, all while making tax simpler, smarter, and more efficient. Change the way you see making tax digital with Xero. Search MTD Ready.
This is Times Radio.
Welcome back. This is me, Dom Jolly, with you till 4pm. Now, what a year it's been for television, from British hits like Adolescence, Amandaland and The Traitors, to the return of heavyweights such as Stranger Things, The Last of Us and Squid Game. It's been a standout year for great TV. Scott Bryan, TV critic to the stars, apparently, joins me now with his highlights from 2025. Hello, Scott.
Afternoon.
How are you?
Yeah, not bad. I'm in the sort of pre-New Year's Eve nap.
Right.
Because I find it's a long day.
Presumably and you're just going to be watching telly all night, are you?
No, of course not. No, I do have times off. I do get day off.
But that's
I mean,
good.
But I mean, certainly, I think bizarrely, probably like kind of like Christmas itself has been a bit dry when it's come to actually TV and good stuff on. But New Year's Day seems to be where it's all at, because you've got the new series of The Night Manager 10 years after the previous one.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people have been swatting up and trying to remember what happened the first time around.
Because yeah, I can't remember anything of that. Yeah,
I think I remember a very pregnant Olivia Colman with a gun.
Right.
I can remember a lot of explosions, but apart from that, I've had to rewatch it. And then there's also the launch of the next series of The Traitors as well.
Oh, can't wait.
Yeah, and I think it'll be quite kind of a lot of people who have probably watched the celebrity series are now probably going to be watching the civilian one, if
Look
you call
them.
It civilian.
These just Johnny because, come latelys.
Yeah, just because it's been that kind of word of mouth hit. But I think tonally it's quite different, because the celebrity one is all quite upbeat and jovial and chatty. And I think the... I think people are going to be shocked about how self-interested and quite, people really take it to task in the civilian one.
Well, to be honest, I think the celebrities were just as devious and cunning, but were just better at hiding it, I think, probably better. Mm. But listen, take me through. It's been a particularly good year for British television. What were your top shows?
I mean, I would say, I mean, in third place, probably Big Boys, which is the kind of semi-autobiographical sort of series created and written by Jack Rook. It's been on Channel 4. It's been a bit of a...
I've not seen this at all.
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, it's been a bit of a... sometimes I find it needed more promotion. But
is it... Sorry, it's a comedy, a drama?
It's both, really.
Okay.
So it's semi-autobiographical. It's about two friends... played by Dylan Llewellyn and John Poynting, and it follows their adventures at university. I mean, what it does well is that it manages to hit you right in the feels, but it also captures, I think, a lot of nostalgia to maybe the early 2010s or late noughties.
Yeah.
Lots of kind of references to the music and the TV of that time. It is very, very well observed, but it's also, I think, kind of quite bittersweet, because it's about grief and it's about friendship. And I think the reason why it makes kind of the top of my list is that the series seems to have come full circle. This is sort of the third and final series. And normally I find with comedy, you know, when it tries to wrap everything up, it doesn't do it as well as maybe the first set of episodes, because, you know, not many shows know how to finish, whilst a lot of shows know how to start. But actually I found that Big Boys could have wrapped it up perfectly. If anything, it sort of was, I think its final episode, and I don't want to reveal what happens really, but the final episode was the finest episode of the whole lot.
Okay.
And I think it really kind of packed a punch. It really did. And some fine performances and a cameo as well by the actual writer who created it, Jack Rook. And that's available, all episodes to watch on Channel 4.
I'm going to give that a look. Then obviously Adolescence was massive.
Yes. I mean, Adolescence, I mean, I think is one of those sort of shows where the stars align in many different ways. I mean, you know, of course, you've got Stephen Graham, who not only stars in it, he is the creator. And I think what was its sort of masterstroke was how it used this, you know, one take approach with the director, Philip Barantini, who had also done Boiling Point with Stephen Graham. So I think people were tuning in to see how this drama would feature episodes all just in one take. I mean, also, of course, starring Owen Cooper, Erin Doherty and Ashley Walters. But then I found that actually what it did so well was that it actually took the material that it was looking into. You know, misogyny, you know, the rise of very sort of hardline voices on the internet, algorithms and the influences that can have on its children, on our children, and does it in a really thoughtful, nuanced approach. And I think, like, when you get to you know, the episode between the psychologist played by Erin Doherty and, of course, the young boy Jamie played by Owen Cooper. And that was his first ever acting role, which is just incredible on a TV set. I think you don't really notice that it's one take anymore, or that becomes a bit more of a background feature. And I think that's just sort of a sign of a really fantastic drama where the performances sort of shine, but it's also, you know, it makes you think. And I think also the fact that, you know, this was a drama that asked many questions about our society today, but didn't go out of its way to answer them. You know, it made it kind of very much the forefront of the national conversation about what we should be doing next and highlighting the problems, without trying to kind of come up with the answers. That's for us to decide.
I totally agree. I absolutely loved it. There was one shot that I just couldn't work out how they did it. It was a kind of chase scene, and then suddenly it went up in the air. And I watched how they did it. They were running around, the cameraman was running, chasing. And then there's a moment where a drone is hovering with a hook, and they hook the camera to the drone while it's still filming, and then the drone takes off. I thought that was absolutely stunning, but that's probably a bit nerdy.
And also that was like in the 49th minute or something. Yeah. So should be thinking, if you're that person who's got to make sure after 49 minutes of previous action that you've got to get that hook just right, otherwise all of that stuff is wasted. You'll be sweating.
100%. I can't remember the name of the director, but I went to see a film about 20 years ago at the Gate in Notting Hill, and it was all done in one take. And they did it 28 times, and they said the 17th time they'd absolutely nailed it, and they'd got like an hour and a half through, and they really thought this would be great. And they got to a hotel, which was the final scene, and some Hollywood celeb walked out at that moment. I can't remember who it was, but Winona Ryder or someone thought the cameras were for her and waved at the cameras, so they had to stop and start again. But I'm a big fan of all those sort of things. Now, your other big pick we've sort of touched on already, but Celebrity Traitors, I mean, it was just massive, wasn't it? I was livid I wasn't on it. I'd love to be on that, but there you go.
Well, I mean, there is a second series on the way. So
yeah, I think I'm way down the list, I'll be honest with you.
But I think it was, you know, something that... Normally, celebrity versions of shows end up being inferior versions just because they feel that they have to bend the rules to make it for them, or that the celebrities don't really know what they've signed up for. And then you end up having something that kind of bridges maybe the main series, but feels a bit like an afterthought. And I found that the Celebrity Traitors, not only with the names attached, you know, household names, Celia Imrie, Nick Mohammed, Stephen Fry, just name but a few, but also I think did not compromise on the format at all. Just had the people as invested in the game as they would have been if they were ordinary members of the public, you know, and still contain kind of the unpredictable nature that makes it so successful.
Well, Joe Marler being that probably that unpredictable thing, wasn't it? Because I don't think anyone thought he was going to sort of burst out of it.
Well, same as Alan Carr. I mean, you know,
well, I knew Alan Carr would be good, I think. But when he killed, what's her name? I always completely forget her name, his best friend.
Oh, Paloma Faith.
Paloma Faith, yeah, that was just fantastic. Right up at the beginning, it was like, okay, he's here to play.
But it was also just like the small production elements too. Like, for example, when they, it feels so weird to say on radio, but when they buried Paloma Faith, it was accompanied to music by Paloma Faith,
yeah,
which was
lovely touch.
Masterstroke.
That must have really, really made it feel better for her, I think.
100%. But like Studio Lambert, you know, they are a...
Yeah, they're the gods, aren't they?
They are just fantastic at doing shows and knowing exactly what audiences want. And this was just the cherry on the tree for them, I think.
I mean, I've been obsessed with Traitors right from the start. My kids used to play a game called Werewolf, which I think it's Nick from, actually. And I've watched almost every international version. The only one I just couldn't do, I tried to watch the New Zealand one, and it was so low rent. It looked like it had been filmed in a Premier Inn. It was just not good. But anyway, some honourable mentions. Leonard and Hungry Paul on the BBC. I've not seen any of these.
So this is a comedy that's been on BBC Two, and it feels like the antidote to pretty much any high-stakes drama that has been on TV all year. It's essentially, it's based on a very successful book by an Irish writer, and it's all about these two boys who are neighbours and are just hanging out with each other and play board games. And from that synopsis, you might go to yourself, oh, this is going to be twee, and it's not going to be any means kind of high stakes or emotional or pack a punch. Like, the main storyline throughout the whole series is whether one of the characters is going to be asking someone else out on a date who they work with. But yet, it just felt wonderful to watch. I think it was the fact that it's a celebration of ordinary lives. It's a celebration of taking things a little bit slowly, not having to be on the internet the entire time, not having to feel enraged by the state of the world. You know, you can still care, but not have to be plugged in all the time. I think it was also incredibly well written and adapted for the screen. Had great performances by the two lead actors, Alex Lawther and Laurie Kynaston, and had great chemistry. And it's just one of those shows that, you know, I'm just happy is there. Really, I mean, yet again, it's all available to watch on iPlayer, but it's just an antidote to every other, you know, show that's been a gun chase or, you know, high stakes yelling. It's a completely tonally opposite. And also, fun fact, the narration is done by Julia Roberts for the series.
Ah, yeah, that's right.
She was a fan of the books. Yeah.
She'd read the books or whatever. Another one that was I watched and I thought was amazing, Louis Theroux, The Settlers. He spent time with a growing community of Israeli religious nationalist settlers. I thought it was classic Louis Theroux, but what was interesting about it was he kind of lost his cool a bit.
Yeah, he lost his cool because he met sort of a hardline sort of nationalist who tried to provoke him by pushing him at one point and basically trying to cause a reaction. And you can kind of sense that, you know, Louis has been in very high stakes scenarios throughout his entire career where he asks posing questions to people who he might not like, but he wants to work out how they tick. And I think this was a time in which, you know, I've never seen him as frustrated and angry, but also holding it in as much as he'd had during that documentary.
Yeah, it was interesting.
I found that documentary kind of one of the finest bits of documentary making all year, I think, just because it just laid out the facts and left you to make up your own mind. And I think it was also just the fact that it just came at a very sort of important time as well. You know, documentaries, I find, always have a purpose as much as a news report in terms of giving you more context and understanding by showing you what it's actually like.
I agree. We're going to have to wrap. We're running out of time, suddenly, Scott. Just quickly, though, your teleflop was The White Lotus. I really enjoyed The White Lotus, except I think the ending was a bit of a damp squib.
I mean, it's sort of two squibs, really. This, in terms of the fact that it kind of just kept going and going and going, kind of trying to sort of see whether there was going to be this amazing payoff, and the payoff just never really happened. You know, the whole thing was basically just kind of pushing you towards this idea that there's going to be a grand conclusion, and alas, there wasn't. And then my other
I've got to finish you off here. Sorry, Scott. No, we are running out of time. My guess. Do we know where the next one is? I think it's going to be Morocco. Is my guess, but I don't know. I don't know if we know. But Scott Bryan, TV critic, thank you very much there for taking us through some of your favourite TV moments of 2025.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock. I'm Dom Jolly, and you're listening to Times Radio. Coming up in my final hour, your guide on how to host the best New Year's Eve party with Good Housekeeping Sarah Ackhurst. I hope my son's not listening. And after 3:30, we'll be joined by the director of a new David Bowie documentary who'll tell us why he chose to focus on the most turbulent chapter of the music icon's career. First, the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Shamima Begum's bid to return to Britain has been given fresh momentum as the European Court of Human Rights has asked the government to explain whether it acted unlawfully in removing her citizenship. The woman who joined Islamic State as a teenager remains detained in Syria. The court's examining whether the decision breached Article 4 of the Convention, which prohibits slavery, servitude and forced labour, and whether the UK failed in its duty to identify and protect a potential victim of trafficking. President Putin has ordered Russia's army to advance into northern Ukraine. As the White House tries to secure a deal to end the war, General Valery Gerasimov, Russia's top military official, says the president wants to expand a buffer zone in the Sumy and Kharkiv regions. He also claimed Russia had liberated more than 30 villages but didn't identify them. Labour has criticised Shadow Attorney General Lord Wolfson KC for acting as a lawyer for the sanctioned Russian billionaire Roman Abramovich. Justice Minister Jake Richards said it was indefensible for him to retain his position on the Conservative front bench due to conflict of interest. The Tories have accused Richards of playing politics. HuffPost political editor Kevin Schofield says that's just life.
There is always politics in these exchanges. I think Labour, to be honest with you, are just enjoying the fact that they are on the front foot for a change and that they've actually got something that they can get their teeth into and attack the Conservatives on because they're so used to playing defence. Yeah, I think there are questions for Lord Wilson to answer, questions for Kemi Badenoch to answer, and I think it's quite interesting that, since this story broke almost a week ago, Kemi Badenoch hasn't said anything publicly on it at all.
Millions of people are swamping A&E for minor problems like earache, coughs and hiccups. New figures from emergency departments in England show nearly 2 million patients turned up with headaches over the past 5 years. Dr. Basha Mukherjee is a GP.
Baffles me that there are definitely people who are willing to spend 8, 12 hours in the waiting room. I do think that one of the fundamental reasons is what people classify as an emergency from their point of view might be something that's causing an inconvenience to them.
Meanwhile, the NHS is warning it could see more flu cases over the coming days as temperatures drop sharply. Health Service medics say while the number of patients in units with the illness is levelling off, pressure on hospitals remains high. The UK Health Security Agency has expanded the current amber cold health alert from two regions to all of England. Countries around the world are beginning to welcome the new year, with Japan and Korea celebrating now. Elsewhere, it's already 2026 in Australia. Before the fireworks over Sydney Harbour, a minute's silence was held to remember the victims of this month's terror attack on Bondi Beach. 15 people were killed when two gunmen opened fire on Hanukkah celebrations on the 14th. And Hogmanay celebrations in Edinburgh could be supported by a new visitor levy. The Scottish capital will, in 2026, become the first city in the UK to charge a transient visitor levy, similar to schemes in European cities like Amsterdam. The city's council leader, Jane Meagher, says she'd be surprised if the so-called tourist tax wasn't used to support funding for the celebrations. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Hello, welcome back to my final hour. This is me, Dom Jolly, filling in for Jane and Fee, and I'll be here until four. Coming up this hour, we'll chat about hosting at New Year, and Juliet Samuel will give her year in review. It's quite fun sitting in the studio here, actually, because we've got the news screens on, and just every hour I'm having like multiple New Year's Eves. We started off with New Zealand, then I watched Sydney, just watching Japan and South Korea. It's a non-stop party, but I'll be knackered. I'll be in bed by nine, but there you go, they'll all be fine. Just one sad message here that I want to help someone out with. John, well, that's not a good start for my first message above to Times Radio. You've not even read it. No, I didn't. I didn't even see it, John, but I've read this one, so I hope that's okay. Anyway, let's go to some New Year hosting. If you've somehow ended up hosting a New Year's Eve party, whether through poor planning, bad luck, or a group chat you forgot to mute, and this is my son. As we speak, my wife has just left my home on her way to London, and already the door camera is just ringing and ringing. It's just terrible. Anyway, don't panic. I'm going to panic, but don't you panic. Before you resign yourself to warm Prosecco and a freezer buffet, help is at hand. Sarah Ackhurst is the Director of Good Housekeeping Kitchen and Homes, and she's here to save us from ourselves with tips on how to pull off a New Year's Eve party that looks effortless, even if it absolutely isn't. Sarah, thanks for joining me. How can you host a good night if you don't actually enjoy hosting?
I know lots of people don't enjoy hosting.
That's me.
But I think the main thing is, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors with people who successfully host. It's basically prep ahead and then make it look effortless at the time. But I think the main thing that everybody needs to remember is just to not put too much pressure on yourself. People generally are not going to remember if you've made everything from scratch, but they will remember if you've kind of left them starving or if you've run out of booze before the bells, which is obviously, as a Scot, sacrilege. So kind of don't be afraid to ask people for help if you want I think that is the main thing. Don't be thinking this is your time to kind of shine. If you don't like cooking and you don't like hosting, just ask people for help. At this time of year, everybody has got their fridges that are still stuffed with stuff they haven't used over Christmas. They thought they were going to. Just ask people to bring stuff. Everyone is more than welcome. It's that kind of occasion, I think. It's a sort of, you just want to have fun. It's kind of, there's none of that family pressure of Christmas or all of that. It's all about, for me anyway, as a Scot, it's all about just having a really good time. And if that means you can't bother cooking, don't bother cooking. Ask people to bring in bits and pieces. And they'll be glad to get rid of stuff that they have in their house that they don't want.
Oh, I agree with you. I'm going to up your Scotsmanship. I basically ask people to bring really nice booze, and then I take it and I hide it in my cupboard and I give them the rubbish stuff. And that means I can stock up for the next year. I sort of often have a theme of, you know, incredibly expensive champagne party. I think is something that'd be really good. Listen, is there a maximum number of guests you can invite before it stops being fun?
I mean, obviously, it completely depends on the space you have available. Listen, you don't want to be generally queuing to use your own loo in your house, like generally as a rule. But I'm kind of more, it's less a question, I think, of the number of people that you have and like who the guests are. So if you know that there's someone, just be careful, like invite people to match your energy, basically.
Oh, no, you don't want to do that. They'll be asleep by 9.
You know, I mean, like if Mike from number 32 came last year and drained your drinks cabinet by 9 p.m, he's probably going to do the same thing again this year. So don't have high expectations.
How do we stop Mike? Do we not tell him about the party, or what do we do? Turn all the lights off when Mike approaches.
Listen, or don't tell him about the dodgy lock in the bathroom and just see how long that lasts.
There you go. If you opt to provide food for your guests, do you go for like a showstopper or just lots of small nibbles?
I think one good way to kind of, I think what you want is you want the optics to look abundant. So you want it to feel like, you know, there's a lot of food there for people. I kind of treat New Year a bit like a wedding. I think there's, you know, much drink will be consumed. We all know that. So you kind of want to pace the eating throughout the evening. I really like those kind of, those big sort of tablescape kind of things, make a feature of it. Basically just get a load of cheese, a load of cold meats, crisps, olives, like, you know, sort of, you can make some fancy bits if you like to add to sort of that, but make a kind of, you know, a decorative sort of shearing board, put some lovely fresh herbs on there to make it look pretty, some like really nice, you know, figs, grapes, that sort of thing. It really looks like you've kind of put a lot of effort in, but basically it's a lot of shop-bought stuff that you've kind of like just presented really nicely. It'll go for the evening.
I'm liking your style here, Sarah. I think this is good. Now, if you have smug, annoying guests like me who are going to do Dry January, I tend to think that the Dry January doesn't start till the next morning. It's not like 1 minute past midnight that's cutting off.
Oh, God, no.
Yeah, so you don't need to get sort of non-alcoholic drinks in, do you?
No, I mean, I think these days, you know, there are a lot of people that don't drink, so I think it is.
Well, don't invite them. It's very simple. Well, I bet from number 52 is not a drinker.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what I was saying at the beginning. Bring the people that match the energy. But if you do happen to have someone who's not partial to a drink, I do like to do something for them, because I do feel like it can be really annoying if you're basically just being offered a tap water or a Diet Coke, a warm Diet Coke. I like to make just a sort of like a simple syrup from like using herbs that you probably have at the moment, like rosemary or sage, just with some sugar and in a sugar syrup, just steep those in there. And then it gives a sort of lovely kind of botanical flavor, which is nice in sort of soft drinks and just sort of elevates it. So just like an apple juice with maybe a kind of ginger beer like top to add a bit of fizz and a sort of rosemary syrup is a really, really nice kind of alternative to.
I like that.
And there's also loads of, you know, non-alcoholic, you know, drinks on the market now, which are pretty good.
Perfect. But, so you just get your herb, get your left in your herb drawer and chuck it in a Coke, and that's absolutely fine.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I'm saying.
What about decor, Christmas decor? Do we need to sort of start to get rid of it? Is it different from New York, or do we just keep it up?
No, just keep it up. I mean, I don't think officially it's supposed to come down. I do tend to take mine down on New Year's Day to the start of the year, but definitely keep your, don't be entertaining, like fancy decorations just for New Year. Just keep your Christmas decorations up. I think lighting is really important. That's a really good way of kind of getting a nice like party atmosphere. Definitely no big light. No one is allowed to turn on the central big light. Nobody needs that. And what I usually do is just get those battery powered string lights and kind of put them, if you've got like glass vases or like glass kind of like jars, just put those in and then make really sort of pretty lights and just kind of like dot those around. Candles, but only where you can see them, obviously, and not at a height that a small child might knock them over.
Of course not.
Casualty style scenario on New Year's Eve. But yeah, kind of low lighting, disguises if you haven't managed to clean the house as well, because like quite frankly, who has at the moment?
Disguise that you haven't cleaned the house. What? Turn off the electricity. Mike from 52 is going to spot that within seconds.
He is, exactly.
Yeah. Just finally, we're just running out of time, but just very quickly, anything that should be avoided at all costs apart from Mike from number 52?
I think just avoid at all costs trying to put any kind of like, trying to make it too regimented, trying to do something that you wouldn't usually do, you know, trying to organize people in this time, we have to do this. Then we all have to sit down for the meal at this point, and then we're doing this, you know, just let it go with the flow.
Just let it go with the flow. Keep Mike from number 52 out and chuck herbs in everything. That's it. Brilliant.
Exactly. That is my good housekeeping advice.
Just absolutely brilliant. Sarah Ackhurst, Director of Good Housekeeping, Kitchen and Homes there. We're telling you how to host a perfect New Year's Eve. Coming up, Times' columnist Juliet Samuel will give her highlights and lowlights of 2025. It's 3:13. This is Dom Jolly on Times Radio.
The Times and the Sunday Times Christmas Charity Appeal 2025. This Christmas, the Times and the Sunday Times are raising vital funds for three deserving charities. Switchback, who mentor prison leavers. Kissing It Better, who help to combat isolation in old age. And World Bicycle Relief, who make schools and healthcare more accessible worldwide. To find out more and donate to any or all of our nominated charities, search Times Charity Appeal now. Thank you.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the Great Rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
So, for my pension investment, should I pay a flat fee or a percentage fee? A percentage fee will get bigger as my pension grows, but Interactive Investor's flat fee will stay the same, meaning I get to keep the money I make. Obviously. It's
raining. For over 500,000 investors, the penny's dropped. A Which? Recommended personal pension provider for 4 years running. Interactive Investor. I think, therefore, II. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
This is Times Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to me, Dom Jolly, with you till four. We're just hours away from 2026. And all this week, we've been hearing from Times columnists as they reflect on the highs, the lows and everything in between from the past year. Juliet Samuels Juliet Samuels's beat spans politics, economics, foreign policy and technology. We've been speaking about everything from why Australian teenagers are turning to LinkedIn to the return of the Conservative Party. And I've been asking her about her two heroes of 2025.
So my heroes of the year are Andrew Norfolk, the Times reporter who passed away this year, and Jonathan Haidt, the American psychologist who has been waging a huge campaign across the world about the dangers of screen time for children. And I think it's sort of broken through this year.
Do you think he'd be very happy with what's going on with the Australian ban, I'd imagine?
Yes, I mean, he said he's happy. So Australia has decided to ban social media for under 16s. We don't know how that's going to work exactly. It's a bit of an experiment, but it's, you know, where we need to start, and it can be adjusted later. And it's a huge step forward in terms of just realizing, you know, what we're doing to the next generation, and that we can stop doing it. We don't have to just succumb to you know, all these, a whole generation being lost to screens, basically.
And do you think it's feasible that that might happen globally? I mean, to me, certainly looking at my kids, they're able to get around almost anything. I'm hearing stories that Australian kids are now having to resort to go on LinkedIn, which is a fate worse than death.
Well, if anything's going to cure you of social media, then LinkedIn is the thing.
I totally agree.
So, yeah. I think obviously kids will get around it. And, you know, a lot of the campaigners on this are, I think, totally correct that actually doing it on a website basis is not the best way to go. What you should do is do it on a device basis, i.e. no internet-enabled devices for under 16s. I think that would be more practical, and I hope that's where we'll end up. But I think it's a huge step forward that, you know, a major developed country government has decided to tackle this, and to, rather than basically throwing up their hands and pretending to be helpless.
Tell me a bit more about Andrew Norfolk.
So Andrew Norfolk was a very well-known Times reporter. He died this year. And what he's best known for is essentially uncovering the grooming gangs scandal, which he did, I think, about 10 years ago. And, you know, he was just a basically rigorous, diligent reporter doing his job. And he was really the first journalist to notice that there was a pattern of crime happening across multiple regional towns in the UK, and to look into it properly and to start talking to victims and joining the dots and taking where the story led him. And he never, you know, expected the story to lead him into ethnic strife or religious conflict or anything of that kind. He just followed where it went. And, you know, when people now online, there's a lot of talk about how, you know, the grooming gangs were covered up. And that is true. But they tend to blame the mainstream media for that. The media covered this up. Well, actually, no, it was Andrew Norfolk who uncovered this, who first brought it to the nation's attention on the front page of the Times, just by doing his job without fear or favour. And, you know, I think that we need to remember and recognise that for as long as this scandal continues.
What about your villains of 2025?
So I have Rachel Reeves, who's probably a popular villain. Essentially, she's, you know, she's managed, she had a big budget last year, which was not a success, which, you know, did huge damage to the economy. And then she came back again this year and doubled down. She went even worse. And, you know, you just talk to people running businesses across the UK economy, and they're just, they don't know what to do. Everything is frozen. They're not investing. They're not hiring. You can see that, you know, the rate of joblessness is going up. And it's essentially because she's too weak to do what needs to be done, which is to tackle the welfare bill. And I think she's really in a space of her own making, a delusion that she's doing what has to be done. And she's incapable of learning the lessons of the damage she's done. And I think we're going to see more of it to come.
Do you think she's safe in her job?
I think she is, insofar as if she goes, you know, more questions about Keir Starmer come up. It may be that at some point it's convenient for her to, convenient for Starmer to sacrifice Reeves in order to buy himself more time. And then he'll replace her with someone probably of a similar outlook, but maybe a bit worse. So we'll see.
What about your second villain?
So my second villain is the guy who shot Charlie Kirk. I should say we don't know, because there's a guy, you know, who's going to stand trial who's called Tyler Robinson, but he hasn't been convicted. But, you know, whoever it is determined did it, whether it's this guy they have who they're going to prosecute or anyone else, I just think the amount of damage done to the cause of discourse and free speech and civic society in the world's most important democracy was just so incalculable from that act, and so awful. And I think the reaction to it is still has a long way to run.
So do I detect you think there's a little bit of a conspiracy going on?
No, I'm really not trying to imply that. I'm just trying to be legally, you know, not say someone's convicted when they haven't been. But no, I'm absolutely not in the camp that think there is some kind of conspiracy and Mossad did it. You know, I just think the justice system should run its course.
Fair enough. looking back at 2025 again, what were your highlights?
I mean, you know, I'm going obviously with news highlights and not personal highlights, but I have to say that the week in June, I think it was, when Israel basically took out all of the senior leadership of the Iranian army, a bunch of nuclear scientists, won control of Iranian airspace, and, you know, persuaded the US to join in, you know, probably setting back the nuclear program for a significant amount of time, I think was one of the most spectacular sort of blows for strikes for the security of the free world that we've seen in a long time. It was, you know, and you've had this regime in Iran that's just been menacing all parts of the Middle East for so many years and waging proxy wars and, you know, exporting horrible ideology and funding militias all over the place. And, you know, building up arsenals of missiles in southern Lebanon, funding Hezbollah to do that. And, you know, within a week, they were just taken out. They were just revealed to the world to be a paper tiger. And it was a pretty spectacular event.
I think whatever your political views or views on Israel, their military capabilities are quite extraordinary. My son was in Beirut on the day that all the pagers blew up with the Hezbollah. And that, I mean, God, there has to be an extraordinary documentary coming for that, about the length of time to set that up, to actually set up a company to sell pagers to Hezbollah to then do it. But I think that was the year before last, but still, I mean, extraordinary, extraordinary thing to happen. What about another highlight?
Oh, well, again, in, you know, news highlights, probably the Supreme Court's ruling of what a woman is was, I think, a massive relief and a great victory for the common sense and, you know, truth that most people in the country believe and for a long time were gagged from saying.
Low points?
Well, unfortunately, we've just probably had my low point, which was the Bondi Beach attack. There I was getting ready to celebrate Hanukkah, and it's just a bit of a gut punch when you see news like that. It's just a pretty grim event, and it feels like there's going to be more.
What would you do if you were prime minister for the day? You've got all day.
Well, you can't get much done in a day, but in my fantasy, I think I would fire 2/3 of the civil service, and then I'd give the last a big pay rise. I'd triple pay for the rest.
Which 2/3 would you fire?
Well, that is why you can't do it in a day. But if you had the prep lined up, really what you'd have to do it properly is to get people into the departments, you know, have a proper going through of who's actually doing the work here. Because, you know, basically I think what we have is a government where 30% of the people do 90% of the work and the rest are creating problems.
Are you going to send Jacob Rees-Mogg in to do that?
Well, he had his chance, and he had longer than a day, and he didn't manage it.
So he did leave cards everywhere asking people where they were.
He did, yeah. I think that was probably his most significant act in that role. But
you're going to be more brutal.
Yeah, maybe Francis Maud got a bit further along, I think.
Right.
He'd be a better version.
Looking back at 2025, what did you least expect? What was not on your bingo card?
Well, I knew that the government of Keir Starmer was going to be very bad, but I didn't think that there would actually be leadership chats, you know, having won a 140-seat majority from where they were. I am quite astonished at the fact that there's a possibility that he may not lead them into the next election. So even with my low expectations, they have failed to meet them.
And finally, what would you like to see in 2026?
Lots of things. I'd like to see Ukraine win the war. I'd like to see British energy prices come down. I'd like to see Kemi Badenoch break through in polling, because I think she has huge potential as a leader that people are only just starting to see.
That's interesting. So let's take those three. How likely do you think, how likely do you think the war will end? But certainly how likely, what constitutes Ukraine winning the war?
I don't think they're going to get back all their territory, but a very conclusive pushback to the borders that they can defend. I think would have been possible if the West had given more aid sooner and not been constantly dithering about what we wanted to do. I don't think at this point that it's likely, you know, they're running out of money, they're so exhausted, and aid is going in the other direction. But, you know, if you ask me for my fantasy wish list, I think for the cause of a safer Europe and world, you know, if Ukraine could push back Russia to the point of, you know, Russia going into exhaustion and having to pause or stop the whole thing, I think that would be a huge event to ensure peace.
And Kemi Badenoch, if you're talking about leaders who, you know, were not performing that well at the beginning, she was certainly, people were already talking about leadership challenges quite early on, but she seems to have had a little bit of a resurgence. She seems to be more confident in PMQs. She seems to be sort of becoming a little more comfortable in her role, but does she have a chance against reform?
Yeah, I think so. It slightly depends what happens with the boats and migration, which is really out of her control and their control. And I'm not that optimistic about that. But if those things were to become less prominent in people's minds and people were to be thinking more about the economy, you know, and if she can make a credible case, not just on the economy, but on migration, on, you know, thinking things through and communicating to the public in a way that's compelling and charismatic, which I think she is, then, yeah, I think there's all to play for. I don't think the Tories are dead. I know a lot of people wrote her off, but I knew that there was something there. She's had some staff changes that I think have helped, but I also just think she's growing in confidence, and it takes a while to learn to do these jobs, and people were premature in their judgment.
What particularly impresses you about her?
I think she's just a very natural speaker. When you really listen to her and she's in her flow, the strength of what she's saying and the sense that she has convictions behind it is very powerful. And I think that is the thing we've really been lacking in our leaders. And if you look at all the leaders who've, you know, done much better than anyone would have thought, whether it's Trump or Farage, they have this quality where you think, well, I'm seeing that the real version of that person. They don't sort of go off the stage and become a different person. And I think that Kemi has that quality, you know, when she's relaxed and when she's at her best. And I think she has a very powerful impetus for really reforming things and being radical about the change that we need. And I don't think she will back down from a fight if she's, you know, believes that's what needs to happen.
I think that's one of the things that's really come through, is that need for people to have politicians who speak human, don't they? And the, you know, the new mayor of New York, possibly Zach Polanski,
yes.
Even,
yes.
And, you know, are all in their own ways, as well as Farage and Trump, speaking human. I haven't thought of Kemi Badenoch as that. I think occasionally when she relaxes, you can see the human, but maybe she's learning to speak human. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think she's just more learning a way to display who she actually is on the public stage and to, you know, release some of the just, you know, tenseness of being in the public eye, because I've seen this of her before in speeches and in other contexts. So, you know, I don't think it's new. It's just, how do you display who you really are on the public stage while also working out that you can't just have verbal diarrhea and say a bunch of stuff, you know, whether it's about maternity leave or, you know, you have to control what you're saying, but also be saying stuff that you really believe. And I think it takes a while to master that.
That was Juliet Samuel, a Times columnist who I spoke to earlier in the week. Now, coming up, I'm very excited, a new David Bowie documentary has been released to coincide with the anniversary, the 10th anniversary of his death, and I will be joined in the studio by the director, Jonathan Stiasny. But first, let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A top European court is pressing the UK over its decision to strip a British woman of her citizenship after she travelled to join the so-called Islamic State as a teenager. The European Court of Human Rights has demanded answers over the case of Shamima Begum in relation to state responsibilities for victims of trafficking before the Home Secretary revoked her British citizenship. She travelled at the age of 15 from East London to territory held by IS a decade ago. Colder weather has pushed all of England into an amber cold alert, which could have a significant impact on some services. The UK Health Security Agency is warning it could lead to a rise in deaths among young vulnerable groups of people. Meteorologist Joe Wheeler says any snow will come later in the night over northern Scotland.
It's tonight, as we start to see this mix of rain, sleet and snow coming south, that we start to pull in this very, very cold air. And once that comes to us, it's going to stay probably well into next week. Whilst temperatures may be 3, 4, 5, it'll actually feel sub-zero in many places.
The fire service says it's waiting for an official investigation to find out what caused a fatal house fire in southeast Wales. Flames broke out in the home of Glenboy in Mountain Ash early this morning when one person died. And Australia's been ringing in 2026, but paused for a poignant minute to remember the victims of the Bondi Beach terror attack. 15 people lost their lives earlier this month when gunmen shot at Jewish celebrations. And Joe Root says England's cricketers can leave Australia proud if they win the final Ash test. They've already lost the famous urn, but they're staying positive ahead of Saturday's showdown in Sydney. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Right, brace yourself. At Co-op, you can get two pizzas and a tub of Ben & Jerry's for a fiver. Yep, a fiver. It's kind of a big deal, eh?
You're unbelievable.
Co-op, owned by you. Right by you.
End 2nd of January. Selected products subject to availability. Co-op crew food stores only. See co-op.co.uk for details.
Incredible snorkeling.
Carnival!
Sunrises and sunsets.
Grilled lobster.
Poppy cats and kayaking.
Morning swim.
Pina coladas.
Serene spas.
If you love the sound of a Caribbean holiday, then Sandals have every little thing covered. Do it all or do nothing at all. Your perfect holiday is waiting at sandals.co.uk. Sale now on. Atoll protected.
At Morrison's, mix and match on three packs of the best party food and get one free. Serve up fancy New Year's Eve nibbles like lobster and prawn mac and cheese bites, prawn coconut curry donuts, and then do your croquettes with tomato chili jam.
Morrison's, to shop at Morrison's.
Majority of stores and online. Prices may vary at Morrison's daily. 176 to 304 grams, £6 each. Offer ends 31st of December.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages. Saturday and Sunday nights from 10 p.m. with Daryl Morris.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to me, Dom Jolly, and I am here till 4 p.m. Now, January will mark 10 years since the sad death of David Bowie. One of music's most influential figures, Bowie blazed a trail of musical trends and pop fashion, reinventing himself and his music across many decades. His breakthrough came in 1969 with Space Oddity, and in the early 70s he became the iconic Ziggy Stardust, a flamboyant sci-fi rock star who changed the face of music. He later co-wrote Fame with Carlos Alomar and John Lennon, earning his first American number one, and continued to explore everything from soul to electronic music. As I know everyone thinks they're the world's biggest Bowie fan, but I am. And as a longtime Bowie fan, I couldn't resist kicking off with sharing a couple of my favourite tracks.
What a surprise! 5 years! Brain hurts a lot!
Now, a new Channel 4 documentary is coming out to coincide with the anniversary of his death and reflect on his final decades. And I'm delighted to say that Jonathan Stiasny, the director of Bowie, The Final Act, joins me in the studio. Now, I mean, firstly, choosing my three favourite Bowie songs is so difficult. That was 5 years, which I loved, off the Ziggy Stardust album, which I was at Live Aid, and he was supposed to play at Live Aid, and he didn't, because I think he showed the Cars documentary.
That's right.
So that's great, but I was annoyed he didn't do that. Teenage Wildlife, which was off Ashes to Ashes, which I loved. Wild is the Wind, which is very pertinent in your documentary. I mean, there's so many I could choose, but I've realised that actually I've chosen all of them in his kind of, supposedly, the golden years.
The perfect 10 years.
And what's brilliant about your documentary, apart from many other things, is that it shows the wilderness years, which were not. So, I mean, let's kick off with, what are your three favourites? Are they all from the 70s?
I mean, it's really difficult to choose, isn't it? Yeah, but, you know, definitely love Sound of Vision, love everything from the Low album, love everything from Hunky Dory.
Yeah.
And, yeah, really love everything from Black Star as well. It's an amazing, beautiful record.
I could talk about these various Bewley brothers, absolutely fantastic. I love some of his collaborations, like This Is Not America with Pat Metheny, Absolute Beginners. Anyway, I loved all this. We could talk about this for ages. Do you know the first thing I ever did when I came to London, the very first thing I did, I went to Heddon Street, which is where Ziggy Stardust's cover was taken.
Yes.
And I've got this incredibly embarrassing picture of me as a 13-year-old in black and white spandex trousers. But anyway.
Fantastic.
So your documentary, Bowie, The Final Act, it goes out on Channel 4 on January the 4th, I think.
The 3rd.
The 3rd, sorry.
Yes, Saturday the 3rd at 10 p.m.
But it has been out in cinemas as well.
Since Boxing Day.
I loved it so much. I didn't know where to start with it. I think one of the things I loved about it was, like, Bowie is so part of everyone's lives, but a lot of this documentary focuses on that kind of slightly odd time from Tin Machine on, when I'd sort of constantly buy a Bowie album thinking, this is it, he's going to come back. And I'd always like one song from it, but it wasn't quite there. Why did you decide to spend so much of that, of the time in the documentary, on the wilderness years, if you like?
I mean, I guess, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call them the wilderness years, but I would say that they're probably, you know, in some ways more revealing of Bowie the human than perhaps, you know, those sort of perfect 10 years that he had from 71 to 81. You know, in the late 80s, we don't really look at the sort of very pop albums that he did right at the end of the 80s, but, you know, they weren't well received. He wasn't happy with them. And I suppose that's a really interesting starting point for a film that wants to talk about what it means to be an artist, what it means to be creative, and how, you know, creative evolution and sort of renewal was, you know, what he was all about. And, you know, looking at that sort of under-examined period during the 90s, it was a great opportunity to really focus in on what it was about Bowie that was so special and so different.
Because it's, I mean, one of the things he's so famous for is being a sort of chameleon, isn't he? Constantly reinventing himself, and in the 70s he did that all the way through. But then there was a moment when he sort of joined Tin Machine, where you sort of felt, in a way, maybe he'd run out. It's sort of almost he'd exhausted himself trying to reinvent, and just wanted to be in a band. And there was these awkward moments that on the documentary where he's on the Wogan show. And, you know, Wogan goes, keep an eye out for the, you know, there's this new band, Tin Machine, keep an eye out for the promising singer. And then they're interviewed as a band. And you love that. And you can see what he's trying to do. But really, it's like, come on, David, we just want to talk about you.
Yes.
And there's this awful moment when John Wilde, is it, from Melody Maker, writes that visceral, awful review of the Tin Machine album, and you find out that Bowie cried when he read it.
Yes.
I think that was just an extraordinary moment.
I mean, I guess that's what the film's about, really, is the vulnerability of making art and how much you put yourself out there. And, you know, Bowie, you know, he'd had 20 years before Tin Machine where he'd made some amazing albums, and then he'd sort of hit a bit of a wall with his creativity. And I suppose Tin Machine, as he talks about it, gave him that opportunity to reset his sort of creative vision. And like John Wilde said himself, you know, John Wilde was a massive Bowie fan.
Yeah.
And, you know, has some regrets, actually.
He was so upset that he said, couldn't even imagine that David Bowie would read my review.
Indeed. He's a lovely man, and he has some regrets over that review, and always will, I think. But, you know, the point about Tin Machine was it just gave Bowie a chance to reset everything, to shake everything up, sort of, you know, shake the kaleidoscope, as it were, and see what came next. And I think it did that for him, and it did it very effectively. So, you know, Tin Machine, some people like them, some people they don't. I actually have quite a soft spot for Tin Machine, but
Do you? Yeah, okay.
Well, they made some great tunes, you know. Okay. And in some ways, if they'd have been in their 20s and they had long hair and jeans, they might have been sort of hitting that grunge thing that was coming out in America at the time. But you know, they weren't. They were in their 40s and they were wearing suits, and maybe a little bit, it was a little bit less acceptable to the sort of younger audience than it would have been had Bowie been a little bit younger.
I've already embarrassed myself, and I realised it when I said it. Dominic has got in touch saying Teenage Wildlife is obviously on the Scary Monsters and Super Creeps album. I said it was Ashes to Ashes. So, yeah, that's it. I'm blown out the water as a Bowie fan. I did know that, actually. I actually wrote my own book called Scary Monsters, so I should have known that. What did you want to do with this documentary? Because Bowie is so well documented, isn't he?
Mm.
And I kind of feel I've watched everything on him. And yet I learnt so much from that, particularly what was brilliant with the people he collaborated with that you spoke to. Talk to me about some of the people you got in the doc.
Well, you know, we were really lucky, and I was really lucky to work with my producer, Dan Hall, who got an amazing cast of contributors for us. You know, people like Goldie, very surprising
that,
contributor,
yeah.
You know, drum and bass, sort of godfather of drum and bass that Bowie, you know, worked with, learnt from. And, you know, there's connections through Bowie's career. You know, he was taking from drum and bass in the way that he'd taken from soul in the mid-70s. But it was sort of, I guess what we wanted to do was look at some of the under-examined parts of Bowie's career, look at that amazing artistic achievement at the end with Black Star, but also find a sort of halfway point between, you know, some of the sort of there's been some amazing documentaries made about Bowie over the years. There's some encyclopedic granular documentaries, and there's some sort of experiential ones.
The Alan Yentob one from the 70s
amazing.
Is just fantastic.
It is, yeah. Still incredible.
There's so many things. So my tech op today absolutely loves Little Wonder. Absolutely loved that. And that was the first Bowie song he ever heard. And he was into jungle and drum and bass, though.
Well, there you go.
But what I loved was that Bowie's just sort of, there was a slightly odd part of the fact that he would sort of almost suck out of everyone the stuff that he needed to keep him going. Hanif Qureishi, for instance, is in this.
Wonderful.
He is amazing. Like, Hanif Qureishi, anyway, is fantastic. Bowie did the music, or I think volunteered. I don't think Qureishi even thought that Bowie would make original music for My Beautiful Laundrette, but he did, and he made it. And there's an
yes, for Buddha of Suburbia.
Buddha of Suburbia. God, I'm completely see. There we go. I haven't done my research.
No worries.
Yeah, yeah. And Hanif Qureishi becomes mates with him, doesn't he? And
that's right.
And he's on, we'll talk about his Glastonbury appearance in a bit, but he's on the bus with him going down to Glastonbury.
Yes.
But then he just says one day, that was it. Bowie sort of dropped him. And he didn't seem too upset by that. But some people might have been a little upset.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is something that we heard from lots of contributors making the film, and it is a sort of, you know, it's a known fact about Bowie. I suppose if you're going to maintain a creative drive and passion over decades, it's understandable that you might need to refresh your influences regularly. And I think, you know, he did it with the Spiders in 73 when he dropped them and moved on. And again, you know, Hanif Qureishi was another example of somebody that he had a very intense relationship and friendship with and then moved on from. I suppose if you're a superstar icon, it must be quite difficult to maintain long-standing relationships with people too. So I can kind of understand it from multiple points of view. But, you know, we wanted to cover those sorts of ideas in the film because we wanted to tell, you know, some of the more human aspects of Bowie's character as well. Not in a sort of, you know, we didn't want to tell stories about his personal life. The film isn't really about that. It's about his work and his art. But you know, we didn't want to stray away or shy away from talking about Bowie the human too.
There was one great bit where he was talking to his very old friend, Dana Gillespie.
Dana,
and she says, you know, they were very good friends, and occasionally friendship involved a bit of horizontalism.
Yes.
Which I thought was just a great expression.
Yes.
Who else did you enjoy talking to about Bowie?
I mean, you know, we were so lucky to speak to so many of his friends and collaborators. Earl Slick was wonderful, his guitarist.
Amazing,
yeah, he's such an amazing sort of rock star out of Central Casting.
Yeah.
And great fun, lovely man. Mike Garson, who was his piano player from, you know, 1972, off and on all the way through to the early 2000s. Tony Visconti, obviously his producer, produced many albums with Bowie, and we were very lucky that he was willing to take part, and, you know, really privileged sort of access to be able to speak to him. Yeah, Dana was one of his friends from the time they were teenagers up until the mid-70s.
And she was at his original Glastonbury appearance, wasn't
it? That's right,
which was 1971.
So it was the first Glastonbury... It was the first time Glastonbury had been called Glastonbury. I think there'd been one the year before, but that was the first time Glastonbury had been called Glastonbury. It was Glastonbury Fair.
And he'd gone down there not really known, and in the end, because everyone, I think, was taking so much acid, he finally went on about 7 in the morning.
That's right, it was 5 in the morning. I mean, I think the thing is, in those days, you know, he'd had Space Oddity, he'd had this sort of hit, but he wasn't hugely widely known. He was still a sort of long-haired hippie and had turned up at Glastonbury hoping to get his slot. But yeah, he ended up getting bumped down the order until he finally was able to play at 5 o'clock in the morning.
But playing a great version of Changes.
Oh, beautiful.
I mean, it was just amazing. I didn't think I'd heard that before. It was
amazing. It isn't widely known, and it is a wonderful rendition. Beautiful, yeah.
And then Glastonbury becomes quite important because, obviously, you know, we don't call him the Wilderness Years. Some people call it the Wilderness Years. But he's slightly started to worry maybe that he's gone out of fashion, or is he going to be able to pull it back together? And then he gets offered to do Glastonbury.
That's right.
Talk us through how that, because he didn't want to do it, did he?
So, I mean, you know, there was some chicanery over getting that Glastonbury gig. Yeah. I think, you know, his promoters and PR people wanted him to play it. He'd spent 10 years. I don't think it was the Wilderness. He was going through a period of creative renewal, but you know, he wasn't hugely popular. Music had been going in different directions while he'd been doing that. You know, we had Britpop exploding, we had sort of rave culture exploding, and he was on the sort of, you know, the older end of
I only say Wilderness just because there's a moment where someone says, remember, he wasn't very cool for a moment.
And indeed,
The idea that Bowie was never...
It's mad, isn't it, to think of it?
Not cool. Yeah. Like, to me, he's always been the coolest person ever existed. So,
absolutely,
yeah.
And you know, I guess, I think it's true. If you look back at that time, there was a feeling, I suppose, certainly with Earthling, which actually was the first, like your producer in there, was the first album that I bought of Bowie's. You know, that sort of hit the right time zone for me. And I worked backwards from there. But I think... Certainly, at that time, he was in his 50s. He'd been playing drum and bass. People felt like he wasn't really pushing the culture forward anymore. He was sort of following a little bit more than he had been. I'm not sure that's totally true, but it's certainly something that was in the ether and that people were talking about. And his PR team and promoters wanted him to play Glastonbury 2000. It was going to be, you know, it was being talked about as potentially the last Glastonbury. It had been, you know, there'd been invasions of fence jumpers for a long time,
right.
And it was sort of becoming a bit unmanageable, and they wanted him to play that Sunday, and trying to persuade both Michael Eavis and David Bowie to play Michael Eavis to book him and David Bowie to play the festival is you know a part of our film. Yeah.
Because Bowie wasn't really playing the hits, and Eavis came to
Indeed.
See Bowie.
Yes.
And I think Bowie did a drum and bass set or something, and Eavis thought, not quite what I want as the headliner. So they didn't know whether he'd play.
That's it. Yeah,
hits.
I mean, you know, Bowie was somebody that, you know, as John Giddings, his long-standing tour promoter, tells us in the film, he was somebody that was much more interested in the future than the past for you know, throughout that time period. He didn't want to play the hits. In fact, in 88 when he was playing with Tin Machine, you know, at that time he said he wasn't going to play the hits anymore. This was something that he felt and sort of pushed throughout his career. But yes, Michael Eavis comes to see him in 99 at the Astoria.
Yeah.
And I think he was playing, you know, maybe some of the drum and bass set, but also some of the Hours album at the time, and the story goes that Eavis left halfway through because he wasn't playing the hits and he didn't think he'd be a great headliner. And then there was some, like, as I say, some PR chicanery to sort of make that happen.
Yeah, and then there's an interesting sort of longer version that I'd seen before, that famous interview with Jeremy Paxman,
yes.
where he basically predicts the future of the internet, which is, I mean, incredible.
Yes.
Right? How on, and especially back then, it was absolutely amazing. But in there, he kind of, I hadn't seen the bit about Glastonbury in that before.
No, yeah, well, we did a bit of digging to find that. That isn't something that went out on Newsnight. That was something that went out on a BBC pop programme called The Ozone. They'd obviously taken some. So we found a little bit about Glastonbury there, and it sort of filled in some of the gaps for us. But yeah, that Paxman interview is absolutely fantastic. And, you know, it is breathtaking now when you watch it through. You know, I'd invite people to watch that interview on YouTube. It is a fascinating piece of cultural prophecy.
He really was a time traveller at that stage. It was quite
amazing. Yeah.
And then he gets persuaded to do Glastonbury. Now, I remember that Glastonbury, looking forward to it personally, because I so loved the way Bowie looked. I was like, oh no, the hair. Because occasionally Bowie, I think, would have bad hair.
Yes.
And I personally think Glastonbury had bad hair. But actually, I think Earl Slick's watching going, great hair, or whatever like that.
Well, you know, he came out looking like the Bowie of 1971. And I think there was a determined sort of, you know, that wasn't accidental.
The original cover of Hunky Dory or whatever.
Indeed, yeah. So that was exactly. Hunky Dory, I think, came out, you know, almost exactly the same time as that first appearance at Glastonbury Fair in 71. And you know, so yeah, Bowie in 2000 comes out on stage looking very much like that Bowie, that younger Bowie.
And he does, wonderful. He kicks off with Wild is the Wind.
Exactly.
And it was just, that was it. And
beautiful,
so,
yeah.
And so how important was that as not a resurgence, like, you know what we're saying when we're saying coming in and out of fashion, but that was a massive moment for him coming back.
Yeah, I mean, I think at that point, you know, as we've been talking about, he had sort of been forgotten. And I think it had been quite some time since that, you know, that 10-year period of all those amazing albums that he put out between 71 and 81, I think people had somewhat forgotten how many hits there are in those albums. You know, he had in his life there's 25, 26 studio albums that were recorded, and an amazing number of hits that, and you know, and in pre-2000, I think people had sort of forgotten how many there were. I think he came out, he played an amazing set, and it reminded people quite how important he was. I think that was what that gig did for him.
And then talk to me about the sort of end of the documentary is amazing, because you're talking about the last album. He finds out that he's ill. Talk to me about that era.
Yeah, so, I mean, I suppose there was a hiatus after 2004. Bowie has a heart attack on stage and disappears for a time. You know, he had a young child and family and sort of, you know, became slightly... made far fewer public appearances, spent 9 years in New York and not putting any albums out. And then in 2013, you know, very surprises the world with the drop of The Next Day, which was, you know, came out on his 67th birthday and released this surprise album, had managed to surprise everybody and keep it a secret, had put all of his band under NDAs and not allowed anybody to talk about it. Brings out this album and sort of, you know, grand re-entrance into music. But yes, subsequently became ill. I think he'd had some health scares during that period of time. And, you know, as the sort of, I believe, straight after The Next Day was recorded, he started recording Black Star with Visconti and his... Well, a jazz band called the Donny McCaslin Jazz Band.
Yeah, talk to me about them. He saw them on a... Where had he seen them play?
He'd seen them with the Maria Schneider Orchestra and had seen Donny McCaslin play with her. I think there was... You know, we gloss over some of the detail that you might find in some of the other films about how he got together with that band, but basically decided that this band were... I think Maria Schneider had been involved in this, but, you know, decided that this band were the band to record this final jazz-influenced album. Amazing sort of fusion of jazz and hip-hop and you know, everything that had come before in his career. You know, some of the parts of the film that we didn't go into, but, you know, they were listening to lots of Kendrick Lamar when they recorded that album. You know, this was a guy...
He never stopped.
Yeah. And, you know, to get to a point in your career and your life when... You know, he was 69 years old by this time and was, you know, obviously very unwell, but to still keep creating, keep moving, keep changing is quite staggering, an artistic achievement and real privilege to talk to some of the people that were in the room with him whilst that was happening.
I was about to say, so you, in a moving moment in the doc, you hear Tony Visconti's lifelong friend and collaborator talking about recording in secret what they all knew would be his last project. I mean, what was that like to capture?
Yeah, I mean, it was very moving. You know, I don't know that they all knew it would be Bowie's last project. I think
they knew he was very ill.
And
there's a moment where he comes into the recording studio and takes his hat off, and he's bald and he's not got any eyebrows, and
indeed,
they kind of know what's going on.
Yes, and you know, I think it was very moving for us to talk to people about that. It was a real privilege for them to share some of their intimate memories of those times with us. I mean, we were very careful. We didn't want to try and be salacious about what we were doing. You know, it's not, as I say, it's not a film about Bowie the sort of private individual. It's a film about Bowie the artist. But yes, you know, the people that he was working with at that time, I think they all felt the weight of responsibility of making this album. And I think they were all blown away and remain blown away by, you know, how joyful how creative he remained at a time when most people probably would, you know, stay at home in bed rather than keep creating.
I think, Black Star is so amazing. I love it as an album, but I do find it difficult to listen to. And I know a lot of people that find that difficult too. In a way, he wrote his own epitaph, a musical epitaph. How many people get to sort of complete their work like that?
I know, amazing. It's as Mike Garson, his longtime piano player, says in the film, you know, he wrote his own Requiem. And I think there are, you know, I guess Mozart did that maybe, but there isn't anybody else that I can think of that's done that in music history. And it is quite incredible.
Listen, I, despite all my factual errors as the world's biggest Bowie fan, I can't compete with you because you know much better. But Jonathan Stiersny, I loved. Tell us what it's called and when it's on.
It's Bowie, the Final Act. It's on Channel 4, the 3rd of January at 10 p.m. It's also in select cinemas across the country and will be for the next couple of weeks.
Thank you so much for coming in. I cannot recommend this enough. Honestly, it's absolutely brilliant. But thank you so much for coming in. It is 3:57. This is Dom Jolly on Times Radio.
Times Radio Breakfast with Visit Scotland. Discover Times Radio's essential weekend briefing, where intelligent conversation meets incisive analysis of all the big stories making the headlines. Exploring the wider news agenda with guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. Times Radio Breakfast, Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 with Visit Scotland. Start your story in Scotland with visitscotland.com/winter.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Incredible snorkeling.
Carnival!
Sunrises and sunsets.
Grilled lobster.
Hobby cats and kayaking.
Morning swim.
Pina coladas.
Serene spas.
If you love the sound of a Caribbean holiday, then Sandals have every little thing covered. Do it all or do nothing at all. Your perfect holiday is waiting at sandals.co.uk. Sale now on. Atoll protected.
The biggest Furniture Village sale of the year is on now. And it's everything you've been waiting for. But hurry, our early bird offers end soon.
Right, brace yourself. At Co-op, you can get two pizzas and a tub of Ben & Jerry's for a fiver. Yep, a fiver. It's kind of a big deal, eh?
You're unbelievable.
Co-op. Owned by you, right by you.
End 2nd of January. Selected products subject to availability. Co-op, Crew, Food Stores only. See co-op.co.uk for details. This is Times Radio.
Well, that's it for me today. Ollie Mann, you've popped in early there.
I have, yes.
I had my radio anxiety dream there. I'm going to let in a little bit of light on the magic. Just while I'm talking to that fantastic director, my whole screen went blank. I didn't know what to do, so I'm waving behind the glass, help, and he's just going, what's wrong with this guy? He's like panicking, but anyway, was great.
Sure,
you're not a Bowie fan, or you are a Bowie fan?
You just assumed that I wasn't a Bowie fan because our tastes are so diverse in different ways.
I didn't know, yeah. Are you?
I am a Bowie fan.
Oh, that's good.
I am
a Bowie fan. All right.
I actually like the late stuff, so I know that goes beyond where the documentary is.
How late?
Like, literally the last three albums.
Oh, I mean, Black Star was amazing.
Yes.
But before that,
I like Thursday's Child off Hours. Do you remember that one?
I don't remember that, no. Slow Burn is one of my favourite. I don't know if you know that one as well. There was always something to grab. Anyway,
two middle-aged men talking about their favourite Bowie song is a pastiche of Times Radio.
That is it from me today. Thanks to my team, Maddie, Eve, Hannah and Joseph. My technical operator, Robin, who's a little wonder. See what I did there? I'll be back tomorrow from 1 p.m. But up next, it's Ollie Mann in for John Pienaar.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
It's 4 o'clock. This is Times Radio Drive, and I'm Ollie Mann. The headlines: the European Court of Human Rights has asked the British government to explain whether it acted unlawfully taking away the citizenship of Shamima Begum, and Vladimir Putin has ordered his troops in northern Ukraine to continue their advance in 2026. Coming up on the show, as Begum's citizenship row returns, I'll be speaking about that to the Times' political editor about what it all means for the ECHR, as well as what 2026 holds for the government. We'll cross to Tehran and to Moscow to keep you across the international developments as the world welcomes in the new year. And as it is New Year's Eve, we'll be looking back over the year's biggest breakthroughs in science, the craziest innovations in tech, and we'll be asking the big question today: what are we all drinking?
This is Times Radio.
But first, let's get a roundup of the latest news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Shamima Begum's bid to return to Britain has been given fresh momentum. The European Court of Human Rights has asked the government to explain whether it acted unlawfully in removing her citizenship. Times Radio's Sinead Garvin has more.
Shamima Begum left her East London home in 2015 and travelled to ISIS-held territory in Syria. She was stripped of her British citizenship in February 2019 on the grounds of national security and remains in a Syrian camp. Now the court wants to know if Article 4 of the Convention was breached that prohibits slavery, servitude and forced labour. Questions are also being asked if the UK failed in its duty to protect a potential victim of trafficking.
Demonstrations in Iran, prompted by the plummeting currency and dire economic conditions, have spread to several other cities. The protests began in Tehran on Sunday. Iran's prosecutor general said any attempt to create instability would be met with a decisive response. Dr. Efrat Sofa is the chair of the Esri Center for Iran and Gulf States Research and says while this is a continuation of protests, there's something unique about these.
The regime is the weakest it's ever been. You see, both from an internal perspective, there has been a drought. The currency has been severely devalued. Subsidies have been scrapped. And so the regime from the inside and externally, following the Iran-Israel war, the regime is increasingly weak. And so what we see are internal elements that are properly threatening the regime now.
President Putin has ordered Russia's army to advance into northern Ukraine. As the White House tries to secure a deal to end the war, General Valery Gerasimov, Russia's top military official, said the president wanted to expand a buffer zone in the Sumy and Kharkiv regions. He also claimed Russia had liberated more than 30 villages, but didn't identify them. Millions of people are going to A&E for minor problems like earache, coughs and hiccups. Nearly 2 million patients sought emergency care for headaches in the past 5 years. GP Dr. Basha Mukherjee says primary care needs a stronger, more reliable system.
Majority of inefficiencies are actually happening in hospitals. That's part of the reason why we're seeing so much of a drain in the NHS altogether. And yet this is the problem, that they won't redirect the funds towards empowering GPs and keeping people well in the community.
The government is facing renewed pressure to publish its delayed guidance on single-sex spaces. It's the new chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission said its updated code of practice, published 4 months ago, was already legally sound. The guidance will be used by businesses and other organisations to inform their provision of single-sex spaces. Responding to complaints, the government said it needed time to assess the 300-page document properly. Japan is one of the latest countries to welcome in 2026. Locals and tourists queued up to ring temple bells in Tokyo at the stroke of midnight. It reflects an ancient Buddhist tradition that claims ringing bells 108 times gets rid of worldly desires. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Drive on Times Radio.
Good afternoon. Happy New Year, nearly. Ollie Mann here sitting in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive this week until 7. Happy New Year to everyone who is listening in, let's see now, Western Australia, China, Malaysia, Japan, did they just say on the news, the Philippines, and of course Mongolia, where I'm sure we have millions of listeners there. Welcome to 2026. If you are in Mongolia, do drop me a text. Love to hear from you. However, here in Britain, it is still, of course, 2025, which means we will be milking the very last opportunity we have to look back over the year gone by, throughout the show. Apropos of which, coming up at 6, my Ollie's Army panel tonight will be nominating their news stories of the year. After 5, I'm going to be talking to the Times Obituaries team, looking back on the significant lives we've lost this year. And this hour, we're going to be looking at the year in science, the year in tech, and believe it or not, the past 25 years in sport, because as we enter 2026, of course, we're entering the next quarter of the 21st century, if you think about that. So we're going to be looking back over the big sporting moments of not just the last year, but the last 25 years. Serena Williams, Tiger Woods, the Mobot, all of that. We'll also, in the next few minutes, be reflecting with Stephen Swinford on the New Year's political messages that are being pumped out these days by our political leaders. I don't recall New Year messages being a thing in past generations. Did that used to happen? Did Tony Blair and John Major used to do a New Year's message? But anyway, in the age of social video, they very much are. We've got some coming tomorrow from Keir and Kemi and Zach. But today we'll be weighing up what we've seen so far from Ed Davey and Nigel Farage. And also, as it is New Year's Eve, we will be talking to a drinks expert later about the cocktails, wines, beers and spirits that we should all be guzzling tonight. Including, of course, the growing trend for low and no alcohol drinking as well. I myself, I was saying earlier to Dom, often alternate these days. I'll have a full alcohol beer and then a zero alcohol beer, and then a full alcohol beer and then a zero alcohol beer. And I can just about, I think, still legally drive. What are you drinking tonight? Let me know. 87222, start your message with the word Times. On social media, we are at Times Radio. You can email my producer, Sophia, studio@times.radio. And you can send your WhatsApp messages, pictures and voice notes to 033-003-2353. Let me know what you're drinking. It's 4 o'clock. It's acceptable on New Year's Eve. And also anything else, of course, that you want to comment on in the show. Now, on this festive day of communal celebration, here is a name that will instantly divide you, Shemima Begum. You'll recall she left Britain when she was 15 to join Islamic State. But after the fall of ISIS in Syria, she had her British citizenship stripped from her. She was found by the Times in a detention camp in northeastern Syria. She remains there today. She's currently banned from returning to the UK. But today, the European Court of Human Rights has formally challenged that decision to strip her of her citizenship, which was made back in 2019. Steve Swinford, political editor of the Times, is here. Hi there, Steve.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for joining me. 6 years on from that decision by Sajid Javid, were you expecting this challenge from the ECHR today, 6 years later?
It's not quite a fully fledged challenge. So what they're doing, it's a formal communication, is what they describe it as. It means they're asking questions about the judgment, and they're asking the government to explain its actions and why it did what it's doing. And that has concerned people in